Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, episode 111. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. As always, a pleasure being here with you, Jay. Yes, it is episode 111, and we have some bugs in the wild. This is going to be a full-on episode about vulnerabilities that have the unfortunate coincidence of all being available for exploitation in the wild. It's not just a theoretical risk. These ones can actually bite you. So, yeah.
Yeah, I have like pages of notes for this episode. Thanks, Joe, by the way. And I guess we should probably plug Claude AI. They are not a sponsor. They are not giving us money. Honestly, I have yet to use it personally, but these notes that it produced were pretty good for coming up with talking points. That's pretty neat. So, yeah, kudos.
Now that you're mentioning the sponsor, let me just cover this briefly. TuxCare is a sponsor for the podcast. So if you need assistance with your patching needs, if you want help keeping your old systems up to date, reach out to TuxCare. We can help you with that. Follow the first link on the description for sign up for the newsletter. If you like to hear me ramble about stuff like I usually do here in the podcast, you'll get that in written form. And now we can dig into the actual meat of today's episode.
Yeah, well, I just want to mention real quick, like, first of all, when it comes to sponsors on this channel, it's always stuff I use, and it's stuff I've used before they became a sponsor. So my Linux servers benefit from live patching. Even though I reboot regularly, I guess I'm that paranoid where I have to have live patching and then I also reboot, but that's just me. But yeah, definitely appreciate that. I just want to also mention my PDF I just recently came out with. It's linked in the description below. If you donate $15 to support Learn Linux TV, you'll get that PDF. It'll also take you to the merch shop, which has some pretty cool stuff. I just came out with a Blue Screen of Death t-shirt that I thought was pretty funny that you guys should check out. Also the Artificial Insanity shirt and the Sudo apt install coffee shirt, which is orders of magnitude the absolute highest selling item in that entire shop. I kid you not. It has probably 100 more orders than any other product, and I appreciate everybody checking that out. So, you know what? Let's get into it.
Funny that you mentioned thousands of orders. You know what also gets thousands of actions? It's GitHub Actions. And this past weekend, specifically on Friday and Saturday, the 14th and the 15th of this month, and this date is important, there was this issue with GitHub Actions in that a very common action that's used there on the platform actually was compromised. And the action that we're mentioning is called tjaction/changed files. It's essentially a trigger that you can use to start your scripts whenever there's new files that get pushed or whenever there's pull requests or any changes to the data in the repository. And you can use that to start other behaviors or run specific tasks. It's very widely used. Apparently, over 23,000 organizations were hit by this, including very large ones. And yeah, this is part of a collection of tools. It's called TJ Actions. It's exclusively used within GitHub. It's part of their marketplace for actions. And it's what you use to create your CI/CD pipelines. So,
yeah, it's pretty bad. I haven't actually used GitHub Actions, so I'll admit a little ignorance here. I always try to manually do everything, and I know that's a waste of time in most cases, but when you have a story like this, obviously, it's possible for things on my end to get compromised just as much as anyone else's. But in this case, there's 23,000 organizations, including large enterprises, that are being bit by this right now.
So the thing is, when you have large repositories or just above a certain threshold of complexity, you don't really want to do the stuff that you're mentioning manually, because you might get pull requests, you might get multiple maintainers, you might get different people touching the code base at different points in time. So it shouldn't just be handled manually. In fact, it's possibly it's more or less impossible to do it manually. When you have to prepare artifacts for different platforms, for different operating systems, different versions, and you want everything up to date, then yeah, having the CI/CD pipeline in place, it's probably the best solution.
That's a really good point, because on my end, I'm doing, you know, I'm the person writing the code, I'm the person doing the code review, I'm the, you know, pretty much everything. I make all the decisions on the infrastructure, which is great, but at the same time, it's also a burden. So it's if you have a large team, or if you're especially for developing a software project for a large application, then yeah, I agree. Doing it manually just doesn't scale. So people use GitHub Actions. GitLab has their own equivalent of the same. Obviously, TJ Actions, like I mentioned, is specific to GitLab. I mean, GitHub. But this is a type of tool that exists in a lot of different Git environments. And yeah, this one was using tags, I believe, to go toward the point toward malicious code, which is interesting.
Yeah, so the code to set up these actions, it's actually hosted on GitHub repositories itself. So the way that you use this in your CI/CD pipeline is that you write a script and you mention a specific tag or commit version of the tool that you want to use. In this case, you would use tjactions/changefiles at a specific version. Versions will typically have a tag associated. It's just a shorthand for a particular commit, for a particular commit or a particular version, making it easier to reference that in the future. Meaning that you can pull changed files at version 40 instead of changed files at commit ID, and then having this huge commit ID that it's really hard to memorize. So the way that the attack happened was that somehow, and this hasn't been made obvious yet, it hasn't been made public yet how this happened, but somehow malicious actors got a hold of the GitHub repository for changed files. And in doing so, they changed the code at particular code versions for changed files. When your script called those particular versions, it would call the malicious code, and that was run inside of your CI/CD pipeline. As you can imagine, during that time, the CI/CD pipeline has access to stuff like tokens and credentials and RSA keys if you use them, and all kinds of secrets. So the attack would pull in a memory scanner, would look for these types of assets in memory, and would log them to the actual log of the CI/CD pipeline. Now, a particular trick that was used here was that the log file for the CI/CD has some filters in place that prevent it from showing tokens, from showing email addresses, from showing passwords, and it's actually pretty effective. So the way that these guys got around this, and again, very loosely using the term here, guys, the way that this was abused was that they would encode in Base64 the tokens and the credentials that they found in memory, and they would write the encoded string to the logs. That would bypass the filters, meaning that when that ran, you could simply look at the logs, and logs would usually be public. You would look at the logs for a particular run of the CI/CD pipeline, and you would have access to those encoded strings. It's very easy to decode that. Base64 is perfectly reversible. So it would make it simple for an attacker to know which repositories had used the changed files and which repositories had logs available. So they would simply go look at the logs and pull those tokens from there. It was pretty effective during those 2 days.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just one of those things we have to always keep in mind. We have these tools that give us a lot of convenience. And, you know, just like your point earlier, we really can't live without them in large projects. But we also just have to keep a watchful eye, because this one put the secrets in plain text.
Even if you were doing everything right, and again, this is the standout thing with supply chain attacks. Even if you're doing everything right, you're not doing something poorly thought out, you're not reusing passwords, you're not failing to secure something, you're not failing to apply patches, or assuming any risky behavior. Supply chain attacks don't really care about any of that. They will pull the rug from under your feet and just make your stuff vulnerable regardless of what you're doing. And that's really something that's difficult to wrap your head around when you're thinking in terms of cybersecurity, because this is the type of thing that's really, really difficult to prevent. This is the type of things over which you have very little to no control at all, and it will come back and bite you. you had your CI/CD pipeline properly deployed, running perfectly fine the day before, and then the next day it was simply hovering up all of your secrets and putting them out in the public eye for everybody to see. And you did nothing wrong. You changed nothing. So it's really difficult to prevent this.
It's more than difficult, because it's one thing to do code audits and code reviews for the stuff that your company or you write yourself, but you can't really do a code audit for like all of the libraries that you're pulling in, because it's one thing to keep up with your own code, but you could have tens of thousands of lines of code, hundreds of lines of code, thousands of lines of code, or even more than that, that's being pulled in, because as a programmer, you're not going to reinvent the wheel every single time. For example, if you're writing an application that needs to access the sound card to play a sound effect, what you're not going to do is write code to access the sound card from scratch. You're going to use a library to access the sound card, pull that in, or if you need to play a video, you're going to have a video library, or keyboard strings. There's a library for this, there's a library for that, which really helps accelerate the speed at which developers program, because there's a library for literally just about everything. And there probably is a library for everything at this point. So you pull in a library to fill in the gaps of your code. And the good thing about this, generally speaking, is these libraries themselves would hopefully have a code review or have bugs filed against them, CVEs filed against them that's later fixed. So over time, they kind of get more resilient. But then, just like you were mentioning earlier, in this situation, the situation could be you wake up one morning with no changes to your code and new builds start having this bug when your team didn't make any changes. You just compile on Monday, everything's fine, compile on Tuesday, and you have a vulnerability.
Yeah. And that's really unsettling when you're doing your best to secure your environment and you believe you finally got there and everything was fine, and now it isn't again. But it's interesting what you just said. One of the comments to the original article, and we have this linked in the description, there's a comment there from somebody who read the article, and he mentioned that companies are looking at the financial side of it. And right now, companies are realizing that by using open source components and by using third-party tools and libraries, like you just described, they gain more, or actually they save more financially than what it costs them to deal with the security problems that might come out of it. And that's an incredible perspective to have on security. Saying that your company is willing to, okay, I'm willing to pay the cost of having cybersecurity problems. I'm willing to go through the hassles of having the software that I create or the product that I put out there being breached and being abused, just because it's more cost efficient to us to actually not having to write all that code from scratch. And that's something weird to wrap your head around.
It is. Yeah, it is. And the other side of this, if you, because it's like a double-edged sword in every way, shape, and form. If you decide, I don't want to use this library anymore because I don't want, even a library that doesn't have any vulnerabilities, you could listen to this podcast and say, you know what, I'm just going to do it manually. That doesn't work in a lot of situations, because you're going to create new code to solve a problem that other programmers have solved, you know, a decade or more ago. And in your defense, you might write the best looking library that I've ever seen, and it might check all the boxes and do all the things, but it's not going to benefit from, you know, years of, you know, people looking at it, poking at it. There's going to be far more vulnerabilities in brand new code than there is in tried and true code. But in neither situation are you protected from vulnerabilities biting you. So it's kind of like I said, it's a double-edged sword. It's like you could write it yourself, you have more vulnerabilities. Like we talked about before, one thing you should absolutely never write yourself is crypto libraries, you know, because you're just asking for it at that point. You're asking for breaches at that point. But at the same time, using a crypto library that's existed for a long time still could have a problem, because like we were talking about just now, supply chain attacks happen, and this is an example of one. So you could have a library that's been great for 15 years and it's been very worthy, and then all of a sudden something like this happens and a tag is pointed at malicious code gets executed, and then secrets start getting dropped into log files in plain text.
Specifically in this case, the leaked credentials included such as AWS access keys, GitHub personal access tokens, NPM tokens, private RSA keys, just regular old passwords and emails, the usual suspects in this type of thing. This was identified by a security firm called Wiz. You might have heard of Wiz again in the news just yesterday, in that Google is going to acquire them for $32 billion. So that's a huge amount of money for a security company, even if you're Alphabet, or Google in this case.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's funny how they're in the news just 5 days apart for completely unrelated reasons. And yeah, good on them.
Yeah, when you said the name of the security group, Wiz, the first thing I thought about was, I don't know how many people actually remember this, the Wiz kids from Radio Shack in the United States, where you bought a Tandy computer and then they'd have this Wiz kids comic book that you can, I think they were free even, they're on a stack by the desk. So I guess the Wiz kids just really ended up being rich. Good on them.
Apparently. Okay, so final notes on this. So the root cause, like we mentioned, was that the credentials for TJ Action Bot were somehow compromised, and we still don't know exactly how. They haven't come out with this yet, meaning that then the attackers got access to the repository, they changed the code. This has been fixed as of this moment, meaning that the malicious code was present on the repository, as far as we can tell, for 2 days, just Friday and Saturday. GitHub suspended the accounts as soon as this was discovered and removed the malicious content, and later the accounts were restored, assuming that there was no more malicious content in TJ Actions. A good thing that you should probably do if you use GitHub Actions right now, go through your logs for Friday and Saturday, look for exposed credentials. The credentials won't be in plain text on those logs, but you'll see these used chunks of Base64 strings, these very large strings with just numbers and letters. Look for those. If you suspect that those might be credentials that have been encoded, you can use Base64-D in Linux and then pass it the string, and you will see the decoded text there. If those are credentials that you're using, you should really rotate those credentials and make sure that you don't use this again anymore, because they might have been compromised. So if you're using GitHub Actions, if something ran on Friday or Saturday, you really need to look at those logs.
So even though we just talked about the remediation, and basically, just like you said, you know, GitHub took it down. It was, you know, fixed. They put it back up. And also two-factor authentication on the bot was enabled, because there was a bot that was used to for this to leak. But my point is, that sounds good, but if we don't really know how it was accessed or how they got into it, I'm not really sure I feel extremely confident that it's truly fixed.
I mean, until they come out with that information, this is probably the best that you're going to hear of anybody talking about this. Apparently, it was the actual credentials for the bot account, so meaning that it wasn't any other vulnerability that got them in. It was the credentials that they somehow got access to. Changing those credentials, adding multi-factor authentication, probably prevents this from happening in the future. But until we actually know exactly how they got in, then yeah, this is probably as good as we're going to get of an answer about this.
It does bring up a question of security posture in general, in regard to that. So just like you said, you know, keep your eyes on the libraries, look at your log files, even if you don't use TJ Actions, use something else. I mean, it's not going to hurt you to spend some time to look at some log files. If you have some Base64, just like you said, you could decode that and see if there's anything in there that shouldn't be. It probably would be a good exercise.
TJ Actions is actually a pretty large collection of actions that you can use in GitHub. It's not just the changed files one. Everything seems to point to changed files being the only one that was compromised, but again, pretty large code base, so might just have been more and we haven't noticed yet.
Right.
For a broader context, supply chain attacks are really, really tricky. I mean, last year we had the XZ sync. That could have escalated to every single Linux system out there having been compromised. This one, probably not as huge of a scope as that, but still 23,000 organizations hit by this and pretty large ones at that. We're going to be hearing about this for quite some time now.
And speaking of the XZ vulnerability, we came so close. It's hard to even imagine how close we came. It was weeks away from adoption into the Linux kernel when it was caught. And it was caught by accident.
By accident.
Incredible.
That's what really drives the point home. IT space, cybersecurity people, we caught the XZ vulnerability right in the nick of time by sheer luck. We got so lucky on that one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Who's not very lucky right now are the people behind Apache Tomcat. Everybody loves Apache Tomcat, don't we?
No, I've had so many problems with that. I worked at a company that I won't name to protect the innocent, that we were always on our toes because the company used Apache Tomcat for their stack. And it was fun. It was fun.
The other trigger word here being Atlassian.
Oh boy, yeah, you nailed it. That's not the company I worked for, but the company I used Atlassian tools, which doesn't narrow it down at all because, you know, ginormous number of companies use them, but it was absolutely that. And someone got into a server and they used Apache Tomcat as their entryway into the infrastructure. Yeah, I remember that.
So right now we have CVE-2025-24813. That's a mouthful. It's a critical security flaw in Apache Tomcat, which is being actively exploited in the wild just 30 hours after public disclosure. This was disclosed just a few days ago. 30 hours later, it was already being found on logs with exploit attempts. There is a proof of concept out in the wild. It's on GitHub. You can find it if you really look for it. And how quickly this started to be attacked just shows how quickly you need to respond to new vulnerabilities. It's really, really difficult to act in a company of any moderate size within 30 hours and having everything patched up. But this is a pretty tricky vulnerability in that the attacker can get, with minimal effort, remote code execution in your systems. So that's really, really bad as well.
I want everyone that works as a sysadmin to bookmark this. And I mean that because it was exploited 30 hours later, just like you said. So, for context, when I was working for someone else, I would ask for a maintenance window because there's a vulnerability or some reason for it. And what I would normally get like 90% of the time is, well, next month is good, or maybe in a couple months when development slows down, we can take the systems offline. This is a story for your security portfolio when you have, pushback. Like, look at this story. We can't wait that long. If someone's telling you that you can't get a maintenance window, it's a great example of letting CTOs know the importance of, taking immediate action, because if you don't, they will.
And this type of vulnerabilities, not just around Apache Tomcat, but Java in general, like the Log4j one. Log4j was being exploited in the wild, and we have records of this. Cloudflare has pretty extensive records on all the internet traffic, and they came out with a report after Log4j that showed it being actively exploited a few days before it was publicly disclosed. It wasn't 30 hours after public disclosure, it was being actively exploited before everybody knew about it. So this isn't just something special about this vulnerability that we're talking right now for Apache Tomcat. This entire ecosystem is really, really prone to this type of very quick turnaround on the exploit after a vulnerability comes out. This particular one. So the conditions in which this can be triggered are nothing special. The way that this works is that if you have write access, if you can upload something to an Apache Tomcat server, you will be able to then get it to execute what you have uploaded. Meaning that if you upload the session file to Apache Tomcat, and you don't need to be logged into any platform running on top of Apache, the default servlet, if it's configured to accept files, which is not by default, and that's probably the saving grace right now for everybody running Apache Tomcat. But if you have configured it to accept uploaded files, you can upload the fake session file that you can then get it to execute, meaning that it can automatically, for example, show you was logged into an application that's running on top of Apache Tomcat. But this is just the proof of concept. This is just the bare minimum exploit vector that you can get right now. This will obviously be further improved to exploit the typical tools that run on top of Apache Tomcat. And that's why I mentioned Atlassian before. That's a workload that is typically deployed on Apache Tomcat, and people know how that works. So it's kind of easy to know what are the paths to get upload permissions and to get an upload pass to work when you have Atlassian deployed there. So the minimal changes that are required for the proof of concept to actually exploit that are probably already being used by threat actors right now. The proof of concept that's out there, the description for how it can be exploited seems pretty benign. That thing that I said, that the default servlet is not configured by default to accept uploads, that's a saving grace, meaning that not all Apache Tomcat servers right now are vulnerable to this. But if you have a typical tool deployed there, if you have a known application deployed there, then it's very easy to improve the proof of concept to exploit that. Meaning that you really, really should look at this vulnerability and look at the latest versions of Tomcat that you have and deploy those as quick as possible.
Yeah, anything Tomcat, anything Java, anything Atlassian, updates are mandatory immediately. Okay, you cannot wait. They have to happen immediately because those are among the most popular tools that we cover that are constantly exploited. And it makes sense. You know, Java's slogan is write once, exploit everywhere. So well, actually it's not, but it may as well be. I know I've used that joke before, yeah. But I'm going to use it again and again. It's just too good.
The turnaround time on the exploit code here, it's also, like you said before, it just doesn't play well with how we do things right now in IT. The maintenance windows, all of that takes a long time. That takes weeks, that takes months to schedule, and it just doesn't align perfectly with handling attacks like this. That's something that we try to drum home every single time when we're creating content for TuxCare, is that you need to respond faster to threats. If your attacker can be on your systems within 30 hours, it doesn't work if you're patching after 30 days. It doesn't work if you're taking 3 weeks to patch. It's just right. Too slow, however you look at it. And while you might be meeting all of the compliance requirements by patching within those weeks, you're not meeting the security requirements. Just patching to fill in the checkboxes is not the same thing as actually patching to getting your system secure.
Yeah, threat actors don't care about your compliance window, just saying.
Yeah. Again, this particular vulnerability, it's described as being trivial to exploit. It doesn't require authentication. The only prerequisite is that Tomcat uses file-based session storage. If you don't know, session storage is the mechanism that you use to share a session between different Tomcat nodes, between different servers. It's highly used in high availability scenarios where you have multiple nodes serving the same application. It lets you have a logged in user that is served by one node, then get served by a different node, then still be logged into the application. It's the mechanism that's behind all of that. So it's very common. It's very normal to see this in typical deployments out there of Tomcat. So it's very easy to find servers that you can exploit with this vulnerability. And again, you don't require authentication for it. As long as you know the path where you can upload, it's pretty easy to send a request there. It will accept it. And then you do a second request for it to actually execute the code that you sent it, and it will do so.
If you look at your security logs, if you have a public-facing web server, just to see what people are doing, you'll often see directory traversal attacks where they know the path. Like they might not even know that you're running Atlassian software, and you might not be running it, but you'll still see in the logs people are trying to get that path just to see if it works. They don't even know you're running it, but they're still trying it. And it's just one of the common things I see in the security logs when I look through it. So it's definitely very popular.
An interesting scenario, and this is something that I usually suggest people to do when I'm giving some talks about this type of security problems. Try to keep your logs for as long as possible. If you can keep logs for years, then do store those logs for years. The best eye-opener you can get in cybersecurity is when a new vulnerability is disclosed and you have the indicators of compromise and you run that on top of the logs that you have from the past year, for example. If you see hits on those indicators of compromise on logs that you assumed were safe, that's an eye-opener for your posture, and that's an eye-opener on how you should handle security in your systems. Getting flagged by a vulnerability like this and finding it in your logs for the previous week means that your systems have already been exploited. So,
right.
Yeah, you really need to pay attention to this.
Yeah, definitely.
The last vulnerability that we have for today is actually a Windows vulnerability. And you might be asking, why are we covering Windows vulnerabilities? Well, it's because it touches on UTF, and UTF is a beast, and we have that beast also on Linux side of things, and I'll actually get to it on why it's also relevant for Linux. I'm talking about CVE-2024-4577. This is a PHP for Windows vulnerabilities. It's a critical remote code execution vulnerability that affects all PHP versions on Windows systems. It got a score of 9.8, which, as you can see, is pretty bad.
May as well be 10 at that point.
Might as well be 10, yeah. Why the hell did you just dock it 0.2 points? So the thing with this one, and you might guess that by the 2024 in the identifier, this isn't actually a new vulnerability. This was disclosed in June of last year. We actually covered it in an episode that we did on the podcast around that time. And this vulnerability, it's actually interesting the way that it works. So UTF has thousands of characters. ASCII has just a couple hundreds. Your code that gets executed on PHP will accept UTF, except in specific cases within the execution pass where it converts the code to ASCII. When it's running on top of Windows, it will actually use an OS function to convert the code, the characters from UTF to ASCII. And the algorithm that it uses, it's called best fit. It's used on all the Windows applications that accept UTF and then store the data in ASCII, for example. And the way that it works, and you might imply that from the name best fit, is that when you pass it a UTF character and it needs to convert it to ASCII, it will actually look at the character that it's receiving and it will look at what looks as much as closest to it as possible in the ASCII character set. As you can imagine, lots of different characters in UTF will get mapped to the same characters in ASCII. Meaning that, for example, the dash character, the minus symbol, there are, 20, 30 different ones in UTF, and they all get mapped to the same symbol on ASCII. So the way that the attack works is that you pass a string of UTF characters that are not exact matches to the ASCII ones, but when converted, will translate to something that you control and that you want it to do. Meaning that you can pass it parameters, for example, minus something, something, and then a pass, for example. And without writing any of those characters, of the actual characters that get flagged, for example, in your firewall that's in front of the application, you can still get it to interpret it as if it was the proper pass, as if it were the proper parameters. And since 2012, there has been a mechanism inside of PHP that actually prevents you from passing parameters in URLs, for example. But since the conversion from UTF to ASCII happens after the checks in that 2012 fix, it doesn't catch that. So it avoids the fixes for that, and it still manages to get malicious content to the actual processing step of PHP. Again, this is really, really nasty.
I remember when PHP, that's been used forever. It's like it reminds me of the days when macros and Word documents were a big thing talked about. But yeah.
It actually reminds me of something called PHP Nuke, which was something that everybody was using before the days of WordPress and the like. Again, very old stuff. So the reason that we're talking about this vulnerability again now, 6 months after it was publicly disclosed, is that it now has the infamous, it now belongs to the infamous CISA's non-exploited vulnerability list, meaning that CISA itself acknowledges that this is being exploited in the wild right now to attack actual targets that are internet connected. Gray Noise, another security firm, they actually detected 1,089 unique IP addresses attempting to exploit this vulnerability just in January of last month. We also know that there are at least 79 different strands of malware that already include this vulnerability as part of the things that they try to exploit when they try to enter different systems, meaning that it's already part of your build a malware toolkit, that you just tick a checkbox and now your malware will look for this vulnerability without any intervention from you. And if it finds it, it will exploit it. This has been found to be especially prevalent in China and in Japan because on those character sets used there are lots of ways that you can pass the string and still get the desired results because the symbols will get mapped to what you wanted and still have those strings appear benign if you're looking at the log files. It's really, really weird when you're looking at the log files and seeing one thing and the actual system is interpreting something different.
Yeah. That's really hard to detect. So we're full of things that are hard to detect during this episode.
And I know I made this connection when we talked about this in June. The reason that this is relevant for Linux systems is not by the particular vulnerability itself. Linux does not use best fit, but UTF itself is just this huge monster that has lots of different things and you will only use a small subset of it at any given time. You might recall something that actually affected Linux systems that was also part of the UTF character set is that UTF has these characters that print nothing, that are invisible, that just control the flow of text, the direction of text that is being printed on screen. So you have these characters that actually switch the direction of text midway through a string. You can start typing something from left to right, and then midway you now start typing right to left, meaning that you will overwrite what you had written there before, and then switch directions again and continue writing as if nothing had happened. When you're looking at the text on your screen or when you're looking at the text on your log files, you will see nothing different. But the actual operating system, the actual programming language, will see all the characters that were entered. It's pretty easy to pass it parameters that you're not seeing, and you're looking at the code, then you'll see nothing at all, and the system will be executing something different that you're not aware of. UTF really is a beast. It's really tricky. It was probably designed by committee to solve 100 different problems all at the same time, and right now it's being abused in every different way possible, precisely because it's trying to do everything for everybody at the same time. And that usually doesn't work that well.
When I have an error in code, I can't count how many times I spend 30 minutes, an hour looking for a problem, and it ends up just being a single missing semicolon. And then I feel bad for not noticing that. So as hard as that is to notice for some of us, I think we've all been there. This is even worse. I mean, it's just incredible. You're literally looking at it and it's right. But it's like behind the curtain, there's another string. And that's what gets executed.
Probably people have already encountered this, but it's one of the reasons that if you now try to paste UTF code into GitHub, and again, talking about GitHub, and it's just a coincidence, or any editor that actually deals with UTF, most of them will now flag you a warning that says, oh, you're pasting characters that are not actually printing anything. Are you okay with printing invisible characters like you're trying to do? And then you will actually have an alert that something weird is going on, and you'll probably want to look or delete that text and just type it again from scratch. But yeah, that was something that people were not expecting to be abused, and it's different the way that the computer interprets what's being written from what it's actually showing you. You might be looking at the most benign text in the world, and behind the scenes it's doing an RM minus RF at root, and that's a problem.
Yep, that is definitely a problem. So we have to, again, be on our toes. There's lots of unsettling security news today that we got to keep in mind, but that's just the way it is. We got to be on our toes.
The common theme for all of these vulnerabilities, I cannot stress this enough. This is actually stuff that's out there in the world. This is stuff that can actually go and bite you and actually affect you. It's not just oh, there's this vulnerability in this edge case that only happens if you're on the space station and you're particularly aligned with something different. That's not the case here. All of these are known to be exploited in the wild. You should be patching your systems as soon as possible. You need to be faster in reacting to these vulnerabilities, because if the attackers can be on top of your systems within a day or little more than a day, then you're in trouble. Look at your logs, keep the logs for as long as possible. Make sure that you're running the latest versions. If you have Windows servers, make sure your PHP that's running there is all up to date. You have updates from the past couple of days now. Make sure Tomcat especially is patched and up to date. Don't get bit by this type of things. It's really difficult to always be on your toes, but again, if you don't, then you know what's waiting.
Mm-hmm. True story.
And I guess that's our episode for today. As always, I'm going to remind you for that newsletter thingy. If you follow the link for TuxCare on the video description, you'll be able to sign up for the TuxCare newsletter. It comes at you every couple of weeks. You'll be able to read me rambling about different stuff, not just hear me here on the podcast. And as always, it was a pleasure. Until the next one.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.